Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. My name is Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode, and I'm pleased to be bringing you today's episode because it's with Terry Edwards. Terry Edwards of the Higgsons, of Gallon Drunk. The charming man that has played on records from artists such as Nick Cave, PJ Harvey, Hot Chip, Spiritualized. The list goes on and on and on, and we're going to chat about that today. He was an absolute gentleman, and you're going to really enjoy this episode. And before we get on with it, let me just say thanks to 76 for producing this. Thanks to everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network. Also, if you do enjoy this, please have a look in the back catalogue because we do talk about some people that Terry has worked with. Terry works regularly with Bedders from Madness. There's an episode with Bedders in the archives. Go and have a look. And Irena Mancini, go and have a listen to that, chat with her. It's a wonderful episode, that one. Just go and have an explore in the back catalogue. And if you're up to speed and you still want more, then I do have a Patreon page. Each week I put up a standalone episode over there, as well as what you get for free each week here. Aside from that, if you still need your podcast recommendations, why not go and check out the podcast magazine that I do with Scroobius Pip and Adam Richardson? It's called Pod Bible. It's a print magazine that goes out inside the Sunday Times. As well as that, it's a digital magazine. You can find out all about that at podbiblemag.com. We also have a podcast for that as well. So why not go and check that out and listen to Pip, Adam or myself chatting to all your favourite podcasters about their podcast and the podcast they enjoy listening to. That's find out all about that at podbiblemag.com. And you can find out everything you need to know about this podcast at offthebeatentrackpodcast.com. Right, I think that's all the plug-in stuff done, so let's get on with why you're here, and that's to listen to this episode. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce today's episode, which is Off the Beaten Track Podcast with Terry Edwards. Sorry to chip in, but I've got another announcement. We have another sponsor. Anyone Can Play Guitar Podcast. If you're in a band or an upcoming singer-songwriter, or you just want to a little look behind the scenes of how the music business works, this podcast is for you. They interview big name guests every week, and the lads go in on topics such as how festivals are put together, the role of today's record companies, the importance of touring, marketing, songwriting, the list goes on. And wait till you hear who they've had on. The Killers, Jimmy Eat World, Editors, Frank Turner, Shed Seven, as well as loads of record company execs, festival organisers and radio DJs, and loads more. Visit acpgmusic.com or wherever you get your podcasts from. It's the Anyone Can Play Guitar podcast. Go and check it out.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Okay, we're recording. We are at the WeWork building in trendy East London. And sitting opposite me today is a very well-dressed Terry Edwards.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I sort of feel like I know you because, I mean, I should say we've never met before, but you're good friends with
with my best mate, and you're also a long time sort of collaborator and worked with Bedders, former guest on here, and I'm sure as we talk about the work that you've done over the years, there's probably going to be paths where you've crossed into the Irene Mancini as well. You said you'd work with as well, so I'm sure there's more, because aside from knowing some of the work that you've done through coming to see you in the past, when I googled some stuff about you, it's insane the amount of people that you've worked with. You must have the greatest phone book in music, Terry.
It's not too bad, actually. It does get quite thick, the old phone book. But I think a lot of it's to do with keeping breathing. And the longer you keep doing this stuff, the more people you tend to meet and play with. And I find it really encouraging that I'm still being asked by strangers. Even last week, there were two emails through to go and play on somebody's records of people I hadn't met and stuff, because they like what I do, and that sort of really, it's life affirming. You know, you think, I did make the right decision all those years ago.
Yeah.
It didn't seem like it when I had to work at Camden Market instead. But it's great, and I'm delighted. It's great to meet fans and all that stuff. So I'm saying, like, a gushing little twat, aren't I? But it's really nice when you sort of, because doing what I do, you know, I'm not in the forefront or in the spotlight a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And frankly, I can pick my saxophone up and go home on the bus, and no one knows who the hell I am. And why should they? You know. But it's so nice when somebody does sort of say, "Oh, I really like what you do." And it's great, gratifying.
There must be something humble amongst you and your friends, because when I had Bedders on here, he said he walked home from Madstock.
Yeah.
How can you walk home from Madstock when you just played on that stage to all of them adoring fans, took a stroll home?
Probably helped you clear your head.
That's exactly why he done it.
Yeah.
Track one, Terry, the song with the greatest ever intro.
I've been cheeky here.
Okay.
I do appreciate it. I have been cheeky here. But it's a nice sort of way to fire off a conversation, in a sense. Mm-hmm. It was the first single that I was ever on, and I was quite young. I was 20, I think, when this came out, was the I Don't Want to Live with Monkeys by the Hicksons. And it does start with a ludicrous introduction, which has got... you can hear us laughing through it, because we all had the giggles by the time we got to do this bit. And just a bunch of almost fully grown men going, "Hoo-ha! Exactly, you're laughing straight away.
Yeah.
It's an ear-catching kick-off, isn't it? But there are lots of songs with great intros and everything, but... that one, I just thought it'd be a nice way to start the chat, really.
Yeah. And for those that may not be aware of the Hicksons, could you just give us a little bit of backstory?
Yeah, I went to university, to the University of East Anglia in Norwich, largely to get into a band, but I did manage to get my degree in music at the same time, but I did largely go to get into a band. And it just so happened that there was a really interesting intake of people there, not just people into music, but Gurinder Chadha, the film director, was there our year as well. You know, so there were lots of just, for some reason, the gods smiled upon this bunch of interesting people. And Charlie Hickson was the lead singer of the band, known as Switch then.
Yeah.
The drummer...
This is Charlie Hickson, later known for the Fast Show
and all that.
Such,
indeed. Simon Chatterton, who drums with the band that I play with, Bedders, in the Near Jazz Experience, at the NJE. He'd just... he took a year between school and university, as did I, because I didn't really want to go. I just wanted to be a pop star. Oh well, best laid plans and all that. But Simon had just been on the road with Alex Harvey for a year at the age of 18. He was drumming with Alex Harvey, and he was clearly the best drummer I'd ever played with, you know, at that age when we were both 19. And then Colin, the bass player, who was a mature student, a few years older than us, but he was from Liverpool, so he's in on that early Liverpool scene, and he played in an early incarnation of Wah Heat with Pete Wiley.
Right.
And so in a new Teardrop Explodes and all that sort of thing. So,
and of
course, when you're 19 and you know someone who's 25, that's a wealth of difference,
course.
Isn't it? You know, nowadays it's next to nothing for me hitting the big 6-0 this year, you know. But at the time, for me, that was just like, these are all the best musicians I've ever played with. And people were really, that post-punk thing of 79 into 80, where the dust had settled, people had started growing their hair out a little bit and everything. But you were still interested in making new music, and that's where the Higsons came from. It was a punk-funk band. Someone said it was the UK's answer to the Talking Heads, whatever the question was in the first place. But
I'd take that. That's a great...
And we were, so we denied it at the time, but of course that's what we were listening to. But actually, all the five members of the band, we all listened to slightly different things. And we were just like five cats in a bag when it came to making the music. But we all had that post-punk energy and the follies of youth and the experience of youth. I think we made some interesting records. We were a really good live band. We never quite got there. We didn't. Maybe we weren't good enough.
Yeah.
It's like the people you're at school with who are bloody brilliant at football, and when they actually get their chance to play for West Ham, don't quite make it. I think the Higgs were a bit like that.
Well, my introduction to the Higgsons came in a very sort of roundabout way, so maybe you could sort of shed a little bit of light onto the connection there. But I had a bootleg cassette of REM at the Borderline playing a secret gig under the name Bingo Handjob.
Indeed, yeah.
And they played a track called Listening to the Higgsons.
Yeah.
Could you shed any light on...
I can shed a lot of light on that. It was written by Robin Hitchcock.
It was written by... And I believe Robin was there as well.
Yeah, so I think it was actually... Robin and REM sort of went back a few years, and that was one of Robin's songs, which I think was initially... the opening line is Lucifer in Frognal listening to the Higgsons. It's about the devil in a flat... in a bedsit. And he's got this really crackly radio he's listening to, and all he can hear is the Higgsons coming up on John Peel.
Really? Wonderful.
Something like that.
I'm sure... Am I right in saying there's a lyric in there that the Higgsons come from Norwich and they eat a lot of porridge?
There is indeed, yes. Originally, I think the studio one didn't have the porridge thing in it, but the live version did.
Yeah.
But it was originally just the Higgsons come from Norwich, but I prefer East Grinstead. Which is interesting, because I think that's where the Scientologists are based, isn't it, East Grinstead?
Is it?
But I think that's possibly coincidental.
Wonderful.
So, yeah, that's the connection. And since then, I have played that song with Robin Hitchcock a few times, and once with a couple of REM members as well. So that's...
Oh, really?
Robin used to have a band called the Venus Three, which had Peter Buck and Mike Mills with him. You'd have to look this up.
Hindu love gods as well?
Pass.
Yeah.
Not my specialist subject. It was hilarious to have had a song written about your band, even if it was slightly, why are the Higgsons being played in my band, not undercurrent to it. But the idea, I think a lot of people came upon that through the REM version. And also I met a couple of musicians when I was touring in the States with Robin Hitchcock once upon a time, and Gillian Welsh and Dave Rawlings. And we did Higgsons as an encore in this thing. And I was introduced to them afterwards as, this is Terry from the Higgsons. They said, oh, we always thought the Higgsons were just a noisy family that lived next door to you. And because they didn't know that the band existed. And of course, that makes a lot of sense.
Of course.
And I kind of like that.
That's quite magical. I like that. Track two. The first song you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you.
Mm. Again, I've cheated slightly because I can't remember exactly. But I do actually... My father was really... liked a lot of opera, funnily enough. But he didn't really subject us to too much of it. But there's a wonderful opera by Offenbach called The Tales of Hoffman, and I remember that being quite touching and not really knowing why. You know that thing when you're a kid and there's something emotional?
Yeah.
It's also a bit like... I do not speak Portuguese, but you start playing Portuguese fado songs and you're in buckets of tears because it's really sad, because the subject matter is sad, even though you can't understand a single word that's being said. But I think emotion takes... It doesn't have to be lyrics, doesn't have to be verbally based for you to feel that emotion at all. So that kind of... I do remember being affected by that, but I think in terms of pop music, the thing that I put George Harrison down for, All Things Must Pass, because I just think those songs like Isn't It a Pity, all those sort of beautifully peaceful, hippie-ish sentiments.
Yeah.
And I was just talking to Simon Charterton earlier, to saying that I was coming in to do this. And he said he remembered when My Sweet Lord came out, and mm-hmm. we would have been 11, 12 or so when that came out, mm-hmm. maybe 11. And he said he remembered feeling hugely, you know, tearfully emotional with that song, but not knowing why, you know. So we both had that George Harrison thing.
Could you equate an emotion to what you felt when you heard that?
Actually, it's quite exhilarating, this idea that there was a powerful thing in everybody feeling that there are all these horrible things going on in the world, but there's a positive. People are generally positive, even amongst really difficult times, and we are living through difficult times. But then maybe we always live through difficult times. And then something comes and hits you round the head like a bereavement or something, which has got nothing to do with the politics of the time, which takes you out in this other place, which can be terribly sad. But I think the thing that I felt about the Harrison, a lot of George Harrison's music, is that it's a positive experience, and you can comment on how crap the world is, but actually, isn't it uplifting that there are other people around who are like-minded, who want it to be better? He says, speaking as a very good atheist, but you know, I do think the power of the power of that is good.
Absolutely. Yeah. How old would you have been then? You said, didn't you?
I would have been sort of on the cusp of kicking into being a miserable teenager.
Mm. So whereabouts was you when you was becoming a miserable teenager? Where was home?
I was brought up in Hornchurch, Essex.
Okay.
Which, when I was born, was actually Essex. It still is postally. And then 5 years later became part of the London Borough of Havering, as London spread out like a pancake mixture goes across the pan. I describe myself as being from the East End of London these days, having lived in E1 for most of my adult life now.
Yeah.
So I consider myself that, but I do. I do have to say Essex.
Yeah. How was growing up in Essex?
It's funny, you don't know any different wherever you're growing up, really, do you? I've had a very lovely family. The sort of thing, problems you have with an older brother.
well, let's talk about that, because having an older brother, was it something that, I mean, was it a musical family? You said about your dad playing opera and that, like.
Oh, he as a listener, sure. He wasn't a terribly musical man. The musical side of things came from my mum's side. She played the piano, and her sister taught me piano as well. Their parents, my grandmother played piano and grandfather played the violin and whatever he could lay his hands on, because he also decided once he'd got the bow out he would play a saw, but it wasn't like the musical saw that you get made like David Coulter and Adrian from Tiger Lily's play, but it was the saw from his shed, just to try and work out how to get the sound out of it. And in later years he got a penny whistle and things like that. He was just interested in music, but not for a living.
Yeah.
Though both those grandparents played at dances or whatever, but had their own jobs.
And so records and stuff, would it be a case of, you know, would your older brother have records? Would you, you know?
No, it's hilarious. We chalk and cheese. If we weren't related, we'd never have met, I don't think.
Really?
You know? We like different types of music. He does like music, but we don't really cross over very much in the things that we do like. So I didn't have the older brother who had the cool record collection with the Velvet Underground in.
I think
I had to discover that for myself through friends and so on and so forth. So no, it was very much my own peers that I would find music through.
Okay. Yeah. And so school, was school in Hornchurch?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's talk about school then. So for track three, the song reminds you of your time at school.
Hmm. Yeah. I've put The Damned and Neat, Neat, Neat.
Yeah.
So this would be later school. This would be when I was 16.
Yeah.
Or so. So
okay.
Not like the. I mean, if you like, I guess a lot of the earlier things was prime glam rock.
Yeah.
Person, really, you know, and everyone likes to talk about the cool stuff, you know, how I was always into T-Rex and everything. I don't think you were 12 then. You were into Mud and Sweet, actually, at the time. That's the glam rock you were into. T-Rex as well, but, you know, it wasn't top of the tree.
Yeah.
And nor was Roxy Music.
Yeah.
You wanted the pop stars with the stupid clothes.
I'll tell you why. I've done this with Alan McGee, and he just said, Sweet. He said, like, you know, when I saw Brian... It was Brian, wasn't it? It was the singer
Brian Connolly, yeah.
Yes, it just thought he was the greatest pop star ever.
Yeah.
And you know, that... You're not meant to be cool at 12, are you?
No,
you know, you're meant to be obsessed with the big, larger-than-life, colourful pop stars.
Yeah.
And,
which you think's cool anyway.
Yeah.
Of course you're being cool, because that's the coolest thing you could like at the age of 12.
So...
And Slade. I didn't mention Slade, did I? You know? I mean, there were these... There's a reason why they sold so many records. They were bloody good.
They were great. And no one described them better than Noel Gallagher when he said, I think, I'll quote, they wrote proper fucking tunes for lads, but looked like fucking Diddy men. I just thought, that couldn't describe Slade any better than that.
And it was not until so with hindsight that I've realised just how good Roy Wood and Wizard were. Because I liked the tunes at the time.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I necessarily bought them. I mean, there was a finite amount of money to own this stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas now you can stream things a lot easier and find things. But if you had to put your hand in your pocket as a school kid and get your pocket money out and buy a record, you didn't have quite so many.
Yeah.
And I don't think I might have owned one Wizard tune and some of the others, but... What a curious and wonderful screwed-up band that is. And they were signed to Harvest, which was EMI's sort of arch-rock label that Wire were on.
Yeah.
And you can probably fill in the gaps of some of the other people that Harvest were on, that were on Harvest. But they weren't bands like Wizard, I can tell you.
Yeah, of course.
But the albums were just like almost prog classics, and the singles were complete opposite. But they were a big wall of noise. I mean, I think the... The person who probably influenced Roy Wood most was probably Phil Spector.
Mm.
And,
definitely.
And he played everything,
yeah.
You know, which I must say I quite appreciate the idea of playing everything and being
of course.
A multi-instrumentalist myself. amazing sounds. So, yeah, but to get back to the song that I chose, actually, The Damn Neat, 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 because that really was a watershed thing. Year zero can go to hell, you know, can have a foot in either camp, but certainly The Damned were one of these things where suddenly you thought, oh yeah, this is fun. And of course they were as much fun with dressing up and everything as the glam rockers, and they went on tour with T-Rex, didn't with Mark Bolan.
I did not know that.
Yeah, there's The Damned and T-Rex, or was it Mark Bolan without T-Rex, but in 77 they went on tour together.
I mean, hey, that's a good night out.
Yes.
But, wow, that's a mishmash, isn't it?
Yeah, and amusingly, to bring things full circle there, if you're this kind of a guy, Tony Visconti's produced albums by both of them now.
Correct.
He's just done the recent Damned album.
That's right.
As well as doing the early T-Rex stuff.
So, you mentioned post-punk earlier, and growing the hair out, and we spoke glam, so we're talking... straight up punk here.
Mm-hmm.
So how old would you have been? 77?
16.
Right, I mean, that's prime, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
How was that?
It was great. As I say, The Damned were the band that really made sense to me. They were fantastic. I couldn't get to see any of these, because not only was I young with, of course, just pocket money, and you'd have to travel from the outskirts of London in to do all this. So I never saw any of these bands first time round at that point. So you'd listen to the records or whatever you could get hold of, and The Damned did it for me. They were faster and more fun and proper. The Sex Pistols, you would hear the occasional track of and everything, and I must admit, I didn't really like Anarchy in the UK. I didn't think it was a great song, and the Antichrist rhyme, I always thought was awful.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say that, having played with Glenn Matlock, one thing he said to me was, oh, I always really hated that rhyme himself, just thinking, well, there you go, that kind of indicated, you know, that even the guy who wrote the music for these things wasn't too pleased with that. And also I was chatting again with Bedders recently, and one or two other people, about The Clash.
Mm-hmm.
And Dave Cummings, who was the original guitarist in the Higgsons and then went on to play with Lloyd Cole in the Commotions and Delamitri. That's his pedigree as a player and everything. And he was saying, live, that they were great, but they weren't great musicians. They were just great live.
Yeah.
And I never saw them live, and I don't think it came over on record as quite how good they could be. So I do have to say that as the wide-eyed teenage punk rocker from the outskirts of London, it was the Damned that did it for me.
So, as someone that has lived his whole life in Essex, 10 minutes from Hornchurch, what was 77 and punk like in Essex?
It was as polarised as the sun could make it, really, you know, because people believed the papers and the Bill Grundy incident and all those sorts of things. And I remember getting chased across the park by this young black lad who was about a year older than me or something, and was wanted to do damage to me because a punk rocker had done damage to his sister. It clearly wasn't me, but it was a punk rocker.
Yeah.
Really? And then I saw him again 6 months later. I'm in absolute fear of this thing, and he was absolutely, that's when he explained to me why he'd chased me. But it could be a bit hairy, you know.
Was you a full-on punk then? Was you dressed in it? Was you living it?
I was certainly as much as you could with your school uniform.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, and the spiky hair. And I can do an advert now for my record store day release, can't I?
There's, of course.
It's called Stop Trying to Sell Me Back My Past, and okay. I clearly am, because it's a reissue of the EPs that I made of cover versions of the Mary Chain and Miles Davis and The Fall and The Cure one that never came out at the time, and a few other bits and pieces.
What track's that?
Friday I'm In Love, In Between Days and Killing an Arab.
Wow.
I can come on to the reason for chatting about that in this particular thing is that I've used my last school photograph as the front cover.
Oh, really?
And there are safety pins on the tie, and but the really brilliant wide lapel on the jacket. You know, that's what that time was. You know, not everyone had the made. No one had got on the bandwagon to make punk, so-called punk clothing.
Yeah.
You just got your stuff DIY out of wherever. You know, DIY was DIY clothing, with the thin black tie and the safety pins and the huge wide collars like you're in the Faces or something. But I mean that was the reality of it then. It wasn't bondage trousers, you know. No one from Hornchurch was going to buy stuff from the Malcolm McLaren Vivian Westwood sex shop, were they?
Of course.
You know, I mean it was very homegrown, that kind of thing.
So did you enjoy school?
Yeah, I got on fine. It was I found the last year a bit boring. I just wanted to get out and make some music. And
you was clear already that that was where you wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, most kids, I of a certain age, you lived for football and playing football, and then the worst thing that could possibly happen to you when you're about 14 is that you suddenly need to wear glasses. I'd been wearing them since I was five, people would have been used to it. But when you're suddenly really interested in girls and music and being cool, and then you realise that you're a bit short-sighted and you have to wear specs.
Yeah.
And it was also at that point that I realised I actually wasn't very good at football, and you couldn't really head a ball with specs on anyway. And so I was already playing instruments. I played instruments for quite a time. And then it just polarised me into that.
Hello. I've interrupted the podcast again, haven't I? Sorry, it won't take a sec. All I want to say is, the songs that we're talking about in this podcast, if we can't play them, it's just because of the regulations regarding playing licensed music and such. So if you want to hear the songs, just go over to Spotify and search Off The Beat and Track Podcast, and you can listen to all the songs, because I've put playlists up for each of these. If you can't find it on there, I'll send links on all the social media accompanying each episode. So you've just got to press that one button and you can go through and you can enjoy all the songs that our guest picks. Anyway, I'll shut up, get back to the podcast. See you on the other side. So that sort of thing, like by deciding that you want to pursue a career in music, what was the kind of reaction to that at school in Essex in the 70s to someone saying that they want to pursue a career in popular music with your wide lapels and your...
Here's an absolute classic for you, which is so of its time, it's marvellous. My mum went to the school open day, talked to the careers master then, and said he wants to be a musician. And he looked down and said, at the reports, and he's got a very good spread of O-levels. He could be a chartered surveyor. And it was the 70s encapsulated that you couldn't be a musician, you ignored a woman who'd said something to you. You know, everything everything that could be wrong about this interchange was wrong, you know. And wherever you are, Mr. King, I became a musician.
Brilliant. Wonderful. So, was you in sort of bands at school? Was there?
Yeah. I mean, there was all like cover things, and of course, pre-punk. You know, I started playing the guitar when I was 13, so 73, 74-ish. And so we were like everyone trying to learn "Smoke on the Water," "Stairway to Heaven," whatever.
Yeah,
all those kinds of things, and wondered what on earth was that Jimi Hendrix chap doing, and how do you get those noises out of your guitar? All that, trying to learn all these things, and there was. Yeah, so I went through several bands. Of course, it's, I don't know if it's the same with you, but, you know, your band could split up after 3 weeks and then you'd be playing with other people, then you'd split up and all you'd be thinking about was, what should I call that? What should I call that? and then you'd write the name of your band on your school books, and then you'd be split up 3 seconds later. And so all those kiddie things that you do with bands, but actually just learning the chops as you go along and learn, trying to... of course, with much smaller hands than you would have as you grow into, and so trying to play songs that that adults had written and could play. But I think that really helped. You know, you just sort of got into working away around your instrument, mainly guitar at that point, although I already played trumpet and piano before the guitar.
Right, okay.
And I didn't start playing the sax till I'd left school. I got one for my 18th birthday.
Right.
And that's when I started playing the sax, because I wanted to... I liked Earl Bostick and Ian Dury's sax player, Davy Payne. They were the two sort of influences on me to play the saxophone.
Yeah.
So being a multi-instrumentalist did start at a reasonably early age.
Yeah.
I blame the parents. My dad had loads of jobs.
Yeah. So, was you a confident young man?
Yeah, I think so. Confidence of youth and all that sort of thing. Yes and no.
Driven?
I wouldn't say so necessarily. I've never been that hung up on practice.
driven to achieve a career in music.
Yeah, but it sounds like it's a career move. I don't know. It wasn't... The only sort of career move plans that I made were very early on in Higson's days, when I'd been about 20, 21, thinking, I can do this till I'm about 40. Because, I mean, getting into the back of a transit van and going around to play is certainly a young man's game. And so, when I'm 40, I'll start writing string quartets. Of course, if you're going to be any good at writing string quartets, you should start them when you're 16. But now I'm, hitting the big 6-0 this year, and I'm still getting in the back of vans and playing pubs and doing bigger things as well, you know. But, all the best laid plans and everything can go by the way. So who'd have known that you don't sell records anymore.
Yeah.
And who'd know that we would be talking like this for something to go... No concept of what life's going to be like when you're 40 or 20 years' time.
Absolutely.
Or anything. So you might as well just get on with it and do the best you can.
Perfect. Well, let's go back for track four, I ask you the first song you remember buying from a record shop.
Mm. Yeah. And I do remember this. It's The Legend of Xanadu by Dave D. Dozy Beaky McIntitch. And obviously I would not have been earning money to do this at the time, but my mum gave me the money to go and buy the record that I wanted to get. Because we'd got a dance set in the house and we were playing records for the first time ever. This was 68-ish, 68, 69-ish.
Yeah.
And I loved that song. And I think it's... when you look back on a lot of the so-called heyday of British singles from late 60s, early 70s, there are a lot of novelty records.
Mm-hmm.
And although that's a good tune, it is a novelty with the whip-cracking sound on it. And I think that's probably what nothing else... Where does that sound come from?
Yeah.
It's a bit like watching a Western and the whip being cracked at the horses and all that sort of thing. And you sort of were trying... You're trying to make sense of life, aren't you, at that really young age and everything. And then going back and listening to it, I'm not remotely ashamed by the single. I think it's greatly good. Yeah. Great, great number one single. There's trumpets over it, and there are things that I'd have heard but not really known what was going on. And, you know, maybe those things sow seeds, maybe they don't.
Yeah, I don't think there's such a thing as, you know, when you say, you know, you look back and you still enjoy our record, and I don't get the guilty pleasure thing. I just think, for me, if something gives you pleasure, it's good, you know.
If it's pleasurable, it's pleasurable. If you're guilty, you're guilty.
Exactly, yeah, we're going with that, So, you know, growing up, you know, through maybe a little bit sort of after that, when you was, you know, going on them sort of trips into the record shops. I presume the record shops were in Hornchurch?
Yeah, this particular one that I got that from wasn't very far from where I lived, and it was actually an electrical store, because what they would have would be the top 10, possibly. I don't know if they'd even have the top 20. Maybe they would. But at the same time, they would sell you a plug.
Yeah.
Or a load of wire, or all these other things that you had no idea what these things were, but it was part of the electric shop.
But that wasn't that rare then, was it?
No.
Record shops were sort of constantly sort of split with other sort of outlets and stuff. I mean, I guess, you know, so many people have when they've done this podcast, have said they bought their first record from Woolworths, which was obviously sold everything. But our mutual friend, I won't say his real name, our mutual friend, I take a little bit of credit in sort of pushing him into to buying records, because the local toy shop that was shutting down in between where we both lived was half a toy shop and half a record shop.
Right.
And so they decided, when they shut down, to sell off all their records for a quid. So I was like, come on, let's get you down there. It's buddies. And it was. I remember there was several sort of places around where, you know, we was living in Essex that would be like an electrical store and would have, you know, a rack of records at the back and things like that.
Yeah. Well, I think that also that there were department stores everywhere, like your Debenhams or whatever, but people forget that Boots was a department store up to a point. I bought my first acoustic guitar from Boots in Romford.
Really?
Yeah.
I remember selling records in Boots.
Yeah, and they just had this little thing, and of course it was cheap. It was it was very cheap, and just thought, well, yes, I'll get that and I'll learn how to play the guitar. This would be 73-74 ish,
right?
But they, and the same with WH Smith, because that had a big record department. I bought the Rolling Stones Satanic Majesties from Smith's, I seem to remember.
My first ever job was running the music department in a WH Smith's.
Well. Were you the record buyer?
Okay. Track 5, Terry.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go clubbing. So I want to know the song that soundtracked your years in clubland.
Again, sort of clubbing. Are you expecting me to be of a certain age to go clubbing?
No.
Because the record I wrote down was actually the song, one of the songs that you danced to when you went to mates' parties at school.
Yep.
Rather than actually go to a club.
No.
This was the one that's... this is where Bowie was doing his Plastic Soul years or whatever. And the funky version of John, I'm Only Dancing, not the earlier hit from the 70s, but the one that came out when he had the picture on the front cover was him being Thomas Newton in The Man Who Fell to Earth.
That's
so
right,
it was that period. It was 76-ish it came out, though it was recorded a couple of years earlier, I think. So it's that sort of, that funkier version of John, I'm Only Dancing. And I remember that being, I think because it was slightly different, it wasn't really the big sort of hit. It was kind of a little bit underground, you know. And all the Bowie fans, you'd really go for that alongside Young Americans and all those sort of... That period of his things. And I associate that with that sort of youthful effervescence of partying.
Yeah.
Partying rather than clubbing, if you'll excuse me. If you want to be a bit more literal about it, when I would go to the Camden Palace for their various nights in the early 80s or 82, 83-ish, the one that I remember being played a lot was Blue Monday, of course. That was a huge clubbing record.
Yeah.
But I actually preferred some of the funky things with real drum kits.
Yeah, yeah. Big fan of Bowie?
Yes and no. I wasn't like the he wasn't the biggest thing in my youth, but he was all around.
Mm.
So, and there were certain holes in record collections, I think, that you find certainly people of a certain generation where you actually didn't. There's no real reason to have bought certain albums because you heard them all the bloody time anywhere else. You won't find a Joy Division album in my collection, not because I necessarily like or dislike them, but everywhere you went, you could hear it. So there was actually no need to shell your money out on it. You could buy something else that you wanted. Mm. You could have as well as that because that was already in your head. So I sort of caught up a little bit more with some of the Bowie stuff a little bit later. And also I think that he was as fallible as the Beatles in that there isn't a perfect Bowie album, or is there? Maybe Station to Station. Well, thing, there was always a track that you would kind of... that one's not for me or something. And the same as you with a lot of different artists, I think, and that's the humanity of the records. And not everyone will agree on which that Duff track might be, necessarily, which is, again, a good thing, you know? So I think I liked the, you know, you'd be aware of the singles, and then once you once you'd heard Aladdin Sane or something like that, you'd go, oh yeah, hang on a minute, maybe that's a perfect Bowie album. Maybe not. I don't know.
Does the perfect album exist?
I'm sure that anyone who's made the perfect album would always like to go back and do something on it again.
Exactly. Great answer. Great answer. Have you got any albums that you listen to that you just think faultless? There's not a duffer on it, or have they all got an Octopus's Garden on it?
I think most of them have, you know, and including myself here. When you go, ouch! I wish I hadn't done that. But interesting question. A faultless album? Hopefully not. Hopefully there isn't a faultless album out there. I always say my favourite record is John Zorn's Naked City. I don't play it every day of the week. But every time I do sort of go back to it, it's one of those things of sheer joy. You think, God, I'd forgotten how good this is.
Yeah. It's a lovely feeling, that, isn't it?
Yeah. So on the flip side of the coin, I played the first three Elvis Costello albums once I discovered them to absolute death. I was working in a record shop in Elm Park, Carnival Records, and I used to put them on a lot, a lot, a lot. I can't really listen to this year's Model anymore.
Really?
Yeah, because I've just done it to death.
Exhausted it.
Yeah, and it's not to say it's a bad record or anything, but it's just I have exhausted those brain cells.
Yeah, I've got several records like that. Mm-hmm. I think through being a
name and shame.
I think through being a DJ.
Oh, of course.
I've had to play at lots of records that when I first heard thought were amazing.
Yeah.
And I've probably played every night, every week for 27 years. And one of those is Blue Monday.
Right.
And I adore that record and order one of my favourite bands. Mm. But it comes on, and every now and again I hear it and I'll go, I remember why I think this is one of the greatest things. But then sometimes it comes to me, oh, bloody hell, Blue Monday again.
Yeah.
And There She Goes by the Lars.
Right, yeah.
But they're a band that everybody, you know, they were a band that come out around the same time as the Roses and the Mondays, which was my kind of punk, was my 16 years
sure,
of age.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was one of them bands that everybody said that the Lars were this band that, you know, they're just the best thing. And I just didn't get it. I just never got it. But I get the joy that is the single There She Goes.
Yeah,
it's pop and it's great.
Mm.
But I played it every night for bloody years, and it's like, I don't want to hear that anymore. I'm sure, I mean, I don't play it anymore, but I think it'd be one of them ones that I reckon if it come on the radio now, I'd think, God, it's a fucking great record, that. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Okay. Favourite song from Essex, home county?
Now, I actually steered away from the obvious on this one.
Who's the obvious?
Ian Dury.
Oh, right, okay.
Me and Jerry and the Blockheads. And I'm particularly fond of Laughter, which I know is kind of the Macbeth album for a lot of people in the band, apart from anything else, which I think is a great album. And I think there's those Ian Dury and the Blockheads albums are all brilliant. But I did get...
I had Baxter on last week.
Oh, did you? Mm.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
I had a good chat about...
But what I've chosen is a song that I just got obsessed with at one point, and it's wrong in the way that it's not actually Wilco's Dr. Feelgood, but it's Chippy Mayo is playing guitar on it, but Down at the Doctor's is one of my all-time favourites, and I did play it on repeat. I'm thankful I haven't played it so much that I don't like it anymore. But I just think it is a perfect record.
Yeah.
If we the just everything about it appeals to me.
Yeah.
And if you were to dissect it, if you put it under the microscope or anything, in a sense, there's nothing to it, is it? It's a 3-4 chord tune, and it rocks away and it boogies away.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why it's so good. You just don't have to think about it. Guitar sounds on it's brilliant. The harmonica on it is wonderful, and the piano solo is something else, isn't it?
Yeah.
8 bars of piano. No piano on the whole record. I love it.
Was that a scene that you embraced as well? Because we've obviously sort of spoke about punk and post-punk and glam, and obviously also there was that period in between there, which was what I guess the press named pub rock. Mm. And a lot of that come from Essex with the likes of Feel Goods and Hot Rods and Kersal Flyers as well?
Yes, Kersal Flyers from South End Kersal.
Yeah.
The drummer, Will Birch, is a well-respected writer, isn't he, these days? He's just finished the Nick Lowe autobiography. I think he did a book on... he's done a book on the Enduri. Did he do a John Peel one as well? Maybe not. I can't remember. But, yeah, he's a published author, Will. There was certainly a scene going on there around the Canvey Island and South End area and various other bits of Essex.
Yeah.
It's a big county, isn't it?
Yeah.
I was aware of it a little bit at the time, and there were kids at my school, my year or maybe year older, who'd been to see them.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Stuff which I didn't get to see at the time, but they absolutely enthralled by it, and I can see why, having seen the footage and listened to the records later, or heard the records at the time. Right, and Cell Block Number 9, they made that their own, didn't they, the Feel Goods?
And aside from, you know, the track you've chose not having Wilco on it, I'm not an expert on the Feel Goods by any means, but whenever you see that early footage, Lee just looks sinister, doesn't he? And, like, it's the sort of bloke you wouldn't bump into a pub. You wouldn't want to bump into in a pub, sorry. And you've just, when you saw Wilco moving across that stage with that guitar... It just looked incendiary. It looked just...
They looked violent in a way that bands didn't look violent at that time. You know, there were the big light shows. There was a lot of concentration on being great musicians. I think there was this period where rock music tried to justify itself as music to say highbrow
yeah.
art or whatever, just to say that we really are as good as orchestras, that, yeah. that sort of aspect yeah. of things.
Definitely.
Which, you know, it's fine if you... There's not. I don't have an opinion on that either way. But then you just... There was this thing which I think punk did take by the horns, was there are these people up on stage playing their stuff as if their life absolutely depends on it, and if you get in the way of them while they're doing this,
yeah.
damage will be done.
Yeah.
You know, and I think Dury had that as well.
Definitely.
With the Kilburns, again, who I didn't see, but there is this essence of a band actually being in the same room as you as opposed to being in a stadium.
Yeah.
And that thing where you can see their eyes and you can see...
Yeah.
the intent
for real,
you know, which was really amazing. There's some fabulous footage of Dr. Filger. There's some I think it's a European TV show they're on or something, and I think that Lee and Wilco are speeding off their brains, and Lee's pulling at his collar on it all the time as if he wants to take his tie off because he's really hot and he really doesn't know what to do with himself.
Yeah.
But he realises, then he takes his hand away from his collar because he really shouldn't take his tie off because he's doing his stuff, and then he puts his hand back up to his neck, and you just, there's this intensity about them.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is just, again, one of those life-affirming things, and you look at that and you go, yeah, that's what I want to do.
Yeah, and you did, and so let's talk about some of the work that you've done then, Terry. So, post Higgson's, where did that take you?
About pretty swiftly to playing with Mark Bedford, but it was a year after the Higgson's. I tried playing with a couple of other bands, and I was frankly the instruments that I was playing, sort of the punk funk thing, had sort of not really taken off hugely, and certainly wasn't, apart from Pigbag, wasn't a terribly commercial venture.
Did you play on that?
No, I didn't. No, I played on the remake. Reach Up, Pigbag, yeah. the one by the Perfecto All Stars.
That was it.
Yeah, I'm on that. And horns went a little bit out of favour, you know, because there'd been the Scar. Had horns on, and there was Dexys and these things, and everything was moving to mechanical instruments.
So would this have been sort of mid to late 80s?
This is 80s. We split up early 86, and then there was that mid 80s bit where I know Steve Norman, I like him a lot, but at the time, if you went into a studio with a saxophone, they're going, we don't want to sound like Spandau Ballet.
Yeah.
You know, and they said, well, okay, fair enough, but there are other ways of playing the saxophone. Yeah. Steve can play it differently to what Spandau Ballet sounds like, you know, so you just think, okay. But there were some bands where it did work, and a lot of the sort of more soulful shoegazing indie bands at the time, before shoegaze became a thing, things like the June Brides or whatever, and Yeah Jazz, there was a band called Yeah Jazz who I played with for a while at that point, who were from the Midlands, who I don't know if the cards had fallen slightly differently, could have filled the shoes of the Smiths. They were doing that kind of that kind of music, those kinds of songs, without the Johnny Marr aspect, of course. So I was just playing in whatever little bits and pieces I could do, and I worked at Rough Trade Distribution at that point, and occasionally Camden Market, whatever I could do to
do session stuff alongside this.
Yeah. And there was a band called Meow, who were on Factory. Mm-hmm. I played on a Peel session for them and a track on a record of theirs. So, odds and sods, you know. And then I had some instrumental music that I wanted to do with double bass, and I didn't know any double bass players. And Dave Cummings, the guitarist I mentioned earlier, he was a friend of Bedders. And he said, well, Mark's not doing anything, because Madness had split up around the same time as the Higgs did, you know, coincidentally. And I think everyone was taking stock a little bit, you know.
Sure.
And he was interested in doing something. And I had his phone number for 2 weeks before I had the courage to phone it up. And we finally...
Why was that? Why was you nervous?
Hello, famous bass player. You don't really know me. We're friend of a friend. I have no money whatsoever. Would you like to come and play on some tunes? You know, I was skint, you know.
Quite the offer.
I couldn't really, you know, it wasn't as if I could offer anything other than, are you interested in playing some tunes?
Yeah.
And he was, and we hit it off straight away. We got the same. We had similarities that, you know, we're both the youngest members of our respective bands, which does put you in a certain position, as you mentioned earlier. We're both a little bit at sea, having had the rug pulled out from what we'd put our heart into for our nascent years for being there, and then we wanted to do music which we hadn't done with our previous bands either.
Yeah.
And we shared a love of some sort of 50s instrumental type music, which is what became Butterfield 8.
Yeah.
We got some downtime in the studio just to try a few things out, and I sent a cassettes to three record companies, one of which was Go Discs, and Andy, who was at Go Discs, was a huge Madness fan, and I think it could have been Bedders coughing on it and he'd have been interested, but thankfully it was much better than that, and we did an album for Go Discs, so that was around 87, 88 ish, and it was just a one off that record, and then we tried to keep the band going as Butterfield 8, but nothing really happened with that, and we just kept in touch and doing bits of music and things. Then Madness got back together. There was the Skull All Stars, of course, which was Mark, Lee and Chrissy Boy from Madness joined me and some other mates to play some things at the Dublin Castle, and this was a few months before the Madstock thing had happened, so it was the first time I think that those three had been in a room playing music for a little while. So there have always been little connections with Madness over the years, but that was the sort of the immediate post Higgs thing that I did, and then I just started playing. The more times you say yes to people and put yourself on records and do things and come up, and again working at Camden Market, the guy who was managing Gun and Drunk worked at a record stall there, Nick Brown, mm-hmm. and his charges, Gun and Drunk, were doing something and wanted some saxophone, and funnily enough, the drummer from Gun and Drunk at the time, Max Deschanay, had been at university same time as me. Didn't know he was a drummer. He didn't play any music there at that time.
Yeah.
He had a band back home, but he didn't like to talk about it. So he was playing. So there were these little connections being made all the time, and then I started playing on Gun and Drunk records, joining the band live, and then Jason from Spiritualized was interested, and John Coxon, who played with Spiritualized as well, said, can you come and play on a remix that Jason's doing for a band? And he'd used some of these baritone sax sessions that I did a couple of takes on a track called The Individual, named after my tattoo, which is on Ladies and Gentlemen, We're Floating in Space. So this is where all of these things start sort of ramping up, that you, the more times you sort of do something, and then you've got to know somebody somewhere. And this isn't through being a relentless networker who goes around putting your face about all the time. All you do is do your job. That's all I've ever done. Yeah. Do my job. Meet, you know, you might meet somebody, you might not. So there are plenty of other sessions that I did at the time that came to absolutely nothing, except they made me a better player, I hope.
Yeah.
So that's always what I... That's, I think, where I'm... That's why you're talking to me now.
Sure.
It's because I've got all these things under my belt now. And that's... It just sort of snowballs, really.
And so you've just found that kind of post-Gal and Drunk, your reputation... As just help the phone to consistently ring and
touch wood
and keep you playing.
Yeah.
How have you found the industry and the changes in it over the last, let's say, 25, 30 years?
I'm sure it's the same as everyone would say, that the internet's been a thing. I would say also that I don't know if. I think people, the ages we were talking about earlier of getting into pop music, people are just as interested in pop music now as they ever were. But I don't think it's as important to own things anymore. So you listen, and the way that younger people listen to music is different to the way that I would obsess about it, probably. And I also think men and women listen to listen to music differently or appreciate it differently. I think boys hoard music. You know, you like a record by the Small Faces, you buy everything that Steve Marriott's ever done. A woman hears a record by the Small Faces and likes that record.
Yeah.
This is being very blanket, but I've noticed this a lot in friends and sort of, and you see boys have their record collections in A to Z, you know, and all these sorts
I've
of things.
I've got a record collection in A to Z in my sort of music shed type thing, the end of my garden, and if I drive past a boot sale or a charity shop or a record shop, I go in, I'm generally told, why do you need another record? You've got loads. Doesn't work like that.
It's true, but it doesn't work like that.
Exactly. Absolutely.
So, in answer to your question, I can't really shed any more light on the way than yes, lots have changed. I think it's the way that people listen and what the actual product is. You know, CDs replaced vinyl for a while. Everyone says how vinyl sales are, you know, going up so much more. They're nowhere near what they were.
Yeah, you know. But do you think that could be it's only when you said something that people don't necessarily want a product.
Mm.
Do you think the kind of vinyl thing is that element of people do are happy to pay for it and to have, you know,
yeah, I think
and to
so.
Have that sort of thing tangible to look at? And
yeah, I think that's the, I mean, I'm a convert to Spotify in recent years, funnily enough, because of using the hire cycles in London.
Oh, really?
Because there's no way that I would ever want to own a bike. I don't want to have anything to do with replacing punctured tyres and all that sort of thing. I'm not going to cycle it every day or whatever. But it's very handy for me to get to and from here and there every now and then. And I'm very happy to pay me 90 quid for the year, whatever it is, so that I can pick up a bike. And it suddenly dawned on me, you don't have to buy every single record that you need to refer to, because as a session musician, there are people might say, oh, you know that Amsterdam by the Beach Boys? I'd like something that sounds like the trumpets on track 3. Well, in the past, I'd have to go out and buy the record and listen to it. And I've built up a huge reference library of music like that at home. I don't have the room or the energy for these kinds of things anymore. I have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of records. I think, actually, now I can find that track on Spotify, I can refer to it, I can do the job that I need to do, and I don't need to own that anymore.
Yeah.
And so I see Spotify as being my library, the place where I can borrow things from, in the same way I borrow a bicycle to get here to talk to you today.
If you was to put a new album out, I'm playing devil's advocate here, put a new album out, how much thought, focus and love would you put into the album artwork, knowing that it might only be something that people might glance at on Spotify and not holding their hands? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, if I put a physical release out, I too put the same amount of thought into it, because the person who wants the actual tangible thing will appreciate it. I want it to look good. And also the credits of that. That's the problem with Spotify is you can't, if you really want to know who played the bass on that track or something, you can't find that out unless you go onto Discogs, you know. Yeah. So you always keep a couple of windows open on that computer, don't you, to find everything out. And that, I think that's the other thing that was so magical about buying a record that you hadn't heard yet. You'd be looking at the cover on the bus on the way home and be trying to glean information from it, you know. Well, bloody good luck if it was Led Zepp 4, because there wasn't very much on there. but if it's somewhere else, you go, oh, yeah, I'm pretty sure that person played the guitar on the such and such album that I've got.
Sure.
You know, and you sort of work out where you stand from all those things. I think it's very important to have credits on albums, because that's where you find my name the most. No, I think it's, you know, it's interesting. I think it's good. And then you do sort of follow things through and find out more. As you probably did looking me up for this talk, to say, did you really do that? Are you on such and such?
There was so many that I didn't know you'd worked with.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I didn't know that you'd worked with Nick Cave.
Mm-hmm.
What did you work on with Nick Cave on?
I played a couple of things for the Murder Ballads album.
Wow.
So I'm on Lovely Creatures on the album. And then a track, very annoyingly, didn't get a credit on it, but then neither did Blixer Bargeld, because they screwed up at the record company. I'm on the Ballad of Robert Moore and Betty Coltrane, which was the B-side of the Kylie single.
Yeah.
You know, you think, I'm on that single, but nobody knows because they haven't got my name on it. So I did a couple of them, and there's a thing that we did with a couple of members of Gallon Drunk for the soundtrack of a film called Mojo, and that's called The Big Hurt, which I think is only used on the credits of the film, but it is on the soundtrack of the album. So, yeah, I've done three things with Nick, I think.
And so did that kind of collaboration around that time lead to the work with Polly Harvey, or was
Polly was earlier.
Oh, right.
Gun and Drunk, when we had From the Heart of Town out as an album, we toured with PJ Harvey, 93,
right.
UK, Europe and America. And then I played on The River on Is This Desire in 97-ish with Polly. And I'd been in the frame to do more stuff over the years, but it wasn't until the last record, the Hope Six Demolition project, that it came to fruition.
Yeah.
That we did the album and then the huge tour and all those things. And Polly, funnily enough, she, again, it goes, the Venn diagram does get a bit three, four-dimensional.
I love it. Join the dots. I love stuff like
but
this.
I was, the Hicksons were signed to Two Tone for a couple of singles. So Jerry Dammers produced the first single of those two. And I'd kept in touch on and off with Jerry. And then when he started doing his Spatial, a.k.a. the Big Sun Ra, orchestra of 25 people, and I played baritone, sax and guitar with that.
Oh, really?
And Polly saw us on Lady Bejeweled Holland.
That's right.
Absolutely loved it. Came to see the band live a couple of times and just said, the next album's going to have a lot of horns on it. And she saw Kenrick Rowe playing drums with Jerry. Said, no, I want him, and I want such and such. And it was like she'd picked all these things out, and in a sense, you'd look at it and go, that's pretty disparate. How's Alan Johannes, who's done some amazing things, but, you know, with bands that you wouldn't imagine would equate with what
we did.
And the two Italian guys, Alessandro and Enrico, how would they work in this thing? And she put together this 10-piece band, and of course it works absolutely brilliantly, but no one else would imagine it or see that.
Yeah.
She actually got a band of soloists together. Yeah. Everyone was a band leader in their own right, in a sense, you know. And actually, everyone came this thing. And if you want to... I like the idea that it's very similar to what Duke Ellington would do. He just chose a band of people that he liked what they did, and he just knew that they would sound good together.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's quite interesting. But no, the connection with Polly goes back to 93.
Wow. Okay, well, it's the last track, and you, hopefully it's on Spotify, because people can go and listen to it right now if it is.
I think it is.
So, for track 7, Terry, if you can give us a track that people may not know that you you would recommend they go and check out.
Yes, this is a tune called The Phantom, and it's by Duke Pearson. Did you do your homework? Did you ever listen to it?
I didn't.
You didn't?
I didn't listen to that track.
I'd not heard of it. I think I'd seen the guy's name because he was on a lot of Blue Note records. And I was just on a long-haul flight with my headphones on and flicking through all the albums and things ahead, and there was that title was up there, and I thought, oh, I'll have a listen to that. And I just put it on repeat of about 6 or 8 times, and it's a 10-minute tune. And I was just fell in love with it. It's I don't know how to. It's simple, but it's groovy. It lopes along beautifully. And then I found out more about
the jazz.
It's jazz-ish. Yes, no, he's a jazz player. Yeah, but it's quite almost voodoo-like.
Oh wow!
You know, but it's fairly slowish tempo. So it grooves along, then the vibes come in, and the flute comes in. Then it changes to the other chord. There are two chords in it, and they go along for a minute at a time. And then every time it changes again, you just go, ah, it's just that it's the most satisfying record. And I would thoroughly recommend it. And he's quite an interesting chap. He had a lot of drug problems, as a lot of the jazzers from that period did, that, you know, heroin was the drug of choice. Or we have no choice, we have to take heroin. So he had a lot of problems, but he did solve them. He got the nickname Duke, I think, either because he idolised Duke Ellington or people saw something in him that was like him. But he was brought back into the fold at Blue Note as an arranger rather than a player at some point after various drug problems. But he's got quite a long career. There's quite a lot of interesting stuff that goes on. It's worth checking out. I think quite a few of his things are on Spotify and other streaming places are available.
Are available.
But I would I'd highly recommend that particular tune. I'm an evangelist for it. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And so, what are you up to these days, then, Terry? What's happening? Are you still doing the regular shows with Mark?
We are doing the regular shows, but not at the Indo because it closed just before Easter last year, unfortunately,
right.
With various, I believe, landlord and rent-related problems, and the landlord is still holding out for somebody to pay an arm and a leg to reopen the premises, so, allegedly. So we have now started playing at Chats Palace in Homerton, in Hackney, second Wednesday of the month, starting in March this year. But we're going to play a couple of things on Record Store Day down on the south coast because our drummer Simon lives in St Leonard, so we play around that neck of the woods sometimes. Last year we put out an album which Adrian Sherwood did the remixes on, and he's agreed to do another couple of tracks for us. So that was for vinyl specifically for Record Store Day. We're going to have another couple of tracks. I think that sold out straight away, so it's been unavailable, and we didn't put it up on any streaming services or online at all. So we're actually going to give that a proper CD release in June.
Oh,
with
wonderful.
Some new tracks, so we're going to be working on that. I'm working with a Swiss singer called Erica Stuckey, who I've done quite a few things with in the past, who isn't known over in the UK at all, but we play a lot of German-speaking territories, mm-hmm. although she sings in English. With Paul Cutterford, who's a wonderful guitarist. So I've got a few festivals and bits and pieces with Erica. NJE and myself as a solo artist going to Finnmark, which is in the northern part of northeastern part of Norway and Finland, up in the Arctic Circle. Got a couple of things there coming up in March and April. NJE stuff as per usual. The RSD release of my back catalogue with The Cure and Fall and so on and so forth. A nice double album there. What else is happening? Yeah, I've got to do the laundry when I get in. Yeah.
So is there a place that you'd say if you want to find out about all of this?
There is thenje.co.uk. Mm-hmm. That's probably your first port of call for the NJE. For myself, I need to revamp my website, so don't bother going there. It's a couple of years out of date.
Okay.
But stuff comes up on Facebook and Twitter. Terry Edwards Esquire, or that you'll find me.
Well, if you're happy, then I'll tag you in it when this comes out, so people can go and find out more.
Lovely,
Terry. Thank you so much.
My great pleasure.
There you go. That was Terry Edwards. What an absolute gent. As touched upon at the beginning, we've got lots of mutual friends but have never met. And it was everyone told me that Terry was a really lovely guy, and they weren't lying. Had a smashing time recording that. Hopefully, I will see you all back next week. And as I mentioned at the beginning, if this is your first time listening and you enjoyed that and you want to check out a few other episodes, why not check out the ones that we mentioned on this, whether that be Betters from Madness or Urania Mancini. Go and give them a listen. And, I'll be back next week. See you later. Bye-bye. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing. www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year, and they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music, and they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. In addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fair Wear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. And they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So go and check them out, because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk, do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15, BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk, official sponsors of Off The Beaten Track podcast.
It's Off The Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network with me, Stu Whiffin.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.